Stay tuned for The Turning Point. So this time of the year, maybe we could turn the headphones up a little bit. Is it possible, or are they all the way up? Yeah. No. Yes. Okay. I guess that's good right there. This time of the year, it's a tricky time for me. Always was a kind of a strange time for me. feeling more than my usual alienation, because it's what Jewish people call the high holidays, the highest, the most holy days, the most holy days of the Jewish year, the most holy days that a religious Jew or other people who are religious Jews who think of all Jews as necessarily being part of the religion, whether they believe it or not, or observe it or not. These days are the most important days. And for a lot of people who aren't observant, it was just another day off. New York City was, for a long time, a very Jewish city. Now it's kind of has about, I think, maybe less than half in the number of Jews that were in New York once upon a time. But there was a time when, out of 8 million people, 2 million of them in the city were Jews. I think that was from the 30s. I think that was around the 40s, in the 1940s and maybe even into the 50s. And then it started to change when people moved to a lot of Jews moved to the suburbs. Same thing with other minority groups, quote-unquote minority groups, or ethnic groups, I should say. That when the Italians got money, the Irish got money, when blacks got money, and now Latinos get money, when they're making enough money to be able to move out of the center of the city, you know, where the slums are, where it's difficult, where it's noisy, where it's tough, where it's a little dangerous, where the schools aren't so good. You know, when, that was the mobility. When you had a chance to move out of the what they called the city, and that was basically Manhattan and the Bronx and parts of Brooklyn. And people moved out to the edges of, if they didn't move out of the city entirely to a suburb where they could commute to the city to their job, they moved to a quieter neighborhood in the city, which was usually someplace out in Queens or parts of Brooklyn. And that's what, that's really what my parents and grandparents did. They moved from neighborhoods that were known to be a little rough and tough and could be even worse than that. And the schools were a little tricky. They moved out to better places for their kids. So out in these neighborhoods, when the people moved out of the city, they seem to have left a few things behind them. I'm sure it's a complicated issue, but one of the things a lot of them left behind them, if they weren't already starting to do that, was their religion. So a lot of people who were more religious in the city became less religious when they moved out of the city. I don't know. It didn't happen, obviously, with everyone, but it happened with a lot of people. And I'm not sure exactly what the reason for that is. But it's a strange time of the year for me because these are the holiest days. Still, to this day, it's one of the religious holidays that the public schools take. There are, you know, certain religious holidays, Christmas, about to the what were the and I guess still are the majority population of the city. Once upon a time, the majority ethnic group was Jews. Before that, it was Protestant, various denominations of Protestants, then the Irish Catholics and the Italian Catholics, now Latinos, who are almost exclusively Catholic, and blacks, who are various forms of Protestant. So there are certain holidays which the schools give you off, where if you were a kid, you'd get the day off, or you'd get even a couple of days off. And the Jewish high holidays used to be those days, and they still are. Now, of course, it's a big issue in the city because there are several hundred thousand Muslims, a very, very significant, quote unquote, minority in the city. And they want to get one or two of their holidays off. And this is a very big issue in the city now. It's going to become a big thing in not just New York City, but other cities, too. As the Muslim population grows from immigration from various parts of the world. So, yeah, the high holidays. And in the neighborhood I grew up in, which was a small, very quiet neighborhood where not much happened and there wasn't even much traffic. It was everybody had their little house and their neat little lawn and their quarter acre of a backyard. Actually, the whole plot, to use a certain word, was a quarter acre. So the backyard was part of it and a small front yard and then the house, little tiny houses. And the whole neighborhood was quiet to begin with. But on the holidays, which are specifically Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year, and I always forget because I'm not observant and not religious. And it's a complicated issue for me. Not because I'm an atheist so much or against the observing the Jewish religion. It's just that I just don't, was never instilled with or never naturally or both cared that much about the religion and never believed that much in God. When I was a kid, I believed in God. I think a lot of kids who, if they are instructed that there is a God who watches over you and will punish you. God was very, the Jewish God was very big not punishing you so much as being, he was very austere. The Jewish God was very austere. We were given to understand that, at least in my neighborhood where I grew up, and our religious teachers and our rabbis. I mean, God was forgiving, of course, but God was very austere, too. He had lots of rules. He had millions of rules. You had to keep kosher if you were a religious Jew. If you didn't, You didn't go to hell. The Jews didn't have a hell where there was a devil, red devil with a horrible look on his face. Looked like he was just about to do something really nasty every second, and he did. And with a pitchfork and the whole thing, and flames and eternal damnation. There wasn't all of that stuff. I think, from what I understand, is there never was, when we went to school, there never was a description of heaven, and there was never a description of hell. Now, there may be, in different kinds of Judaism, in the more Orthodox or even Hasidic Jews, they may actually believe in, I think they do believe in demons and spirits and even angels. So that's mostly from Central and East, especially Eastern Europe. And it's a place that's steeped in that kind of thing. And whether or not they believe that if you follow all the rules and you're a good observant Jew, you go to a kind of heaven to be with God, I don't know what it looks like. I don't know. And I don't know if they believe that if you are constantly going against the will of God or violating his, and it's definitely his, rules, and rules for almost every kind of behavior, like how you look at people, what you wear, when you have sex, when you don't, how you pray, whether or not you do this on the Sabbath or that on the Sabbath. I mean, there's a lot of rules if you're an observant Jew. But it's the same with any religion. I mean, if you're a very strict Catholic, I suppose it's the same way, and on and on and on with other religions that are fundamentalist. But in my neighborhood, whether or not people believed in God, I never really took a poll. I was a kid. But when you're a kid, people say God will punish you for that. People, I think what they meant was that they didn't like what you were doing, and they wanted to scare the crap out of you, which Catholics can understand very well. I mean, think of George Carlin's routine. I used to be a Roman Catholic. Is that what the title of it is? I think so. And, the idea of hell and, burning and damnation and eternal torment of various types was something that the Catholics got whipped into them all the time, sometimes literally whipped into them in the Catholic schools. But then theoretically, or presumably, I hope at least, that that's nowhere done anymore. But it was difficult then. And now, and in Jewish religion too, I mean, if you were in a strict family, fundamentalist family, there was the occasional smack, if you weren't doing the right thing or observing the right way to behave. And there were condemnations, and people would yell at you and, give you to understand that you were a really nasty, evil little kid. And there were all these concepts of good and evil and what God would like and what God wouldn't like. But in my neighborhood, it wasn't such a big deal. We were what's called conservative Jews. And that's not like religion. That's not like politics. Where conservatives, you think automatically, you have a picture in your mind of somebody who's a conservative, like a senator from Kansas or something. No. This just meant that you were sort of a middle or moderate Jew. What we're called Reform, and you can imagine what that is, Reform Jews, didn't obey as many of the rules, they didn't observe as much of the Sabbath, that kind of thing. And the Orthodox, or even the ultra-Orthodox, were very heavily laden with rules. But the high holidays were the same for almost everybody, and you had the time off. And it wasn't just a holiday from school, which for a lot of people in this country, religious holidays are just holidays from school. The kids get off. Nobody in the family is particularly religious, and this is what happens. So in this neighborhood, people were kind of in the middle. They were sort of moderate. And what happened there is that on Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Now, Rosh Hashanah is the Jewish New Year, and I don't have a Jewish calendar, and I really don't know what year it is. But it's something like the year 5,700 something or other. I want to say in advance to any religious or knowledgeable Jews who are listening, I apologize in advance for my my abysmal ignorance of my own religion and its various points, maybe even its various pronunciations of holidays. But so it's the year 5,700 and something or other. And where that dates from, I don't know. It could date from Abraham. Could date from Abraham, who is really basically the human founder of monotheism, of the Jewish religion, although the Egyptians have a claim to that too. But let's say he's the founder, the original patriarch, the actual founder, the original Jew. So maybe it dates from there, that the world is that old. But that's the Jewish calendar. So why do I feel even a little bit more alienated, perhaps, on these days? Because when I was growing up, although in my own house it was, astoundingly dysfunctional, which created a sort of permanent sense of alienation in me, which I constantly have to fight against. I have to, cross the divide from no man's land back into humanity, back into the regular flow of things. Almost every day, when I get up every day, I have to start all over again. And, if things are working, I do a pretty good job. But during these high holidays, it was a very special time in my neighborhood. And even though it wasn't super religious or ultra-Orthodox religious, it was a special time. And even we went to the synagogue. It's like, imagine if you're Christian and you go to church on, I don't know, on Christmas and Easter. So the religious Jews, maybe they would go to synagogue, moderately religious Jews or sort of slightly religious Jews, which is what we were. We went on Rosh Hashanah and we went on Yom Kippur or Yom Kippur. How you pronounce it, I couldn't exactly say. It's spelled Y-O-M-K-I-P-P-U-R or K-I-P-P-O-R. We used to call it Yom Kippur, which I think is probably a mispronunciation. It's probably Yom Kippur. And Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year. So well, first comes the Jewish New Year. And then approximately 10 days later, I don't know exactly how it works in the calendar, comes Yom Kippur. So these days are the most special days of the Jewish New Year. And it's a beginning. It's a start all over again. You get to restart things. You get to reboot everything all over again, your life, your direction in life, but especially your relationship to God and to other people. As I mentioned, since I am sort of a lapsed or not really started right in the first place Jew, I will go to Wikipedia, which I'm sure is pathetic to people who are very Jewish. They don't need to go to Wikipedia. But according to Jewish tradition, God inscribes Yom Kippur, by the way, is the end of this week. It's Friday evening and Saturday. So it's the day that begins on Friday evening and ends on Saturday evening, this coming Friday and Saturday. According to Jewish tradition, God inscribes each person's fate for the coming year into a book, the Book of Life, on Rosh Hashanah, and waits until Yom Kippur to seal the verdict. That's a little confusing. I mean, if he's putting down each person's fate, he waits until Yom Kippur to seal the verdict. I mean, isn't he doing it in advance? But I really don't know his ways, so... During the days of awe, these several days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, a Jew tries to amend his or her behavior and seek forgiveness for wrongs done against God and against other human beings. The evening and the day of Yom Kippur are set aside for public and private petitions and confessions of guilt. At the end of Yom Kippur, one hopes that they have been forgiven by God and, I presume, of course, other human beings. But I remember it as a child as a really special kind of a time. And the only time in my neighborhood, since we weren't that religious, that we fasted, that we didn't eat for a whole day. And we didn't start the night before. A day in a Jewish... like Sabbath starts on a Friday night. So that's the day, Friday night to Saturday night. And Yom Kippur starts on a Friday night and goes to Saturday night. So the day starts the evening before. Now, we didn't fast then, but what you're supposed to do is fast that whole 24 hours. Nothing, I don't know if you're allowed to drink water, but you're not supposed to eat anything. And that was the one day in my neighborhood where Jews... And not only that, and this is what religious Jews do every Sabbath, you know, they don't necessarily fast. I don't know if they fast or not, but some do, I suppose. But you don't play the radio, you don't play the television, you don't drive in the car, and you don't make phone calls, and you don't take phone calls. And this is what religious Jews do all the time. However, the only time we did it in my neighborhood was once a year on this day. And it was an extraordinary experience for me. Absolutely extraordinary experience. And you never saw people walking the streets and getting together in a kind of a quiet, I don't know, awed way, except on that one day in my neighborhood. And I remember very clearly the quiet, because there was no TV on. There was no radio on. People didn't make that many calls because they knew nobody was going to, you know, it's not that the neighborhood wasn't entirely Jewish, but it was, I don't know, 60-70% Jewish, the part I lived in. And it was one of the times when things were extremely quiet, and you felt a sense of awe, of inspiration, of dedication that you felt at no other time. And then you also felt, you know, at no other time of the year. Then what you also felt was a sense of connection, or at least the awareness of common disconnection and the desire to reconnect with other people. So you'd walk along the street to the synagogue. We'd walk over to the synagogue, and in this quiet, and we would say hello to neighbors that we ordinarily maybe didn't have that much to say to ordinarily, and people would walk along talking quietly. Everybody was quiet. Otherwise, it was it was a lot of arguing and yapping, and you know adversity between neighbors, the usual stuff that went on in neighborhoods like this. But yeah, your tree is growing over onto my lawn. All right, you want me to cut it down for you? You know, that kind of thing. So none of this. On this day, everybody seemed to be friendly. Everybody seemed to be quietly respectful to everybody else. And it really impressed me when I was a kid. I said, what could command, what power could get all these people to act this way on this one day? And then, of course, the first thing you think is when you get a little older, when you're, you know, like 11, 12, 13, depending on how sensitive you might be, you think, well then why don't people act this way every day? Why don't people act this way every day? And so it's called in English, it's called the Day of Atonement, the Day of Atonement. And what fascinates me is when you look at that, when you look at the word itself, atonement, and I have no idea if this is correct or not. It's a day when you're supposed to atone for your sins. And this was explained to me. You know, sin, I don't know exactly what you want to call a sin. A sin is something, when I think of the word sin, I think of Catholicism, you know, where everything was a sin. And you think of George Carlin, you know, everything was a sin. A thought was a sin. A word was a sin. A deed could be a sin. There was a million sins. But apparently there were sins, too, in Judaism. And that was the only time of the year I heard about this was... Because otherwise, people didn't use that word in my neighborhood if they were Jewish. They didn't say, that's sinful, or you're committing a sin, or God will punish you for your sins. We didn't hear that word. And we didn't hear the word evil. And things like that we didn't hear. Or hell, you know, or heaven. But and during those days, people talked about being forgiven their sins by God and by other people, if they were forgiven, and confessing their sins to God and to other people. Sins being what? Sins being how you said a bad, how you talked nasty to your mother, how you didn't do what your father told you to do, how you were screwing up in school, how you get into fights all the time, how you didn't do your homework. I mean, there were plenty of childhood sins that you could classify, right? And it could be even other sins too. The Jews didn't make such a big deal about sins involving sex as the Catholics did. Those were the worst sins for the Catholics. But for the Jews, it wasn't such a big deal. The worst kind of thing you could do as a sin as a Jew was not to study, at least in my neighborhood. If you didn't study and, you know, try to become a doctor or a lawyer, that could send you to hell in my neighborhood. But in other places, I don't really know. But it was the Day of Atonement. And look at the word atonement. If you separate it out in three pieces, three parts, it's at-one-ment, which fascinates me. At-one-ment, a day of at-one-ment with God. So presumably what's happened is during the course of the year, because of the exigencies of life, because of the bombardment of circumstances, because of the pull of old emotions and new emotions, you become confused. You say and do things that you might not choose to say and do. You act in ways which are negligent or abusive to other people. You're rude, you're nasty, you're inconsiderate, you're insensitive. You do things or say things which you know are wrong, but you have to try to get ahead in the world, and it's a complicated world to live in, right? But these are wrong things. They're wrong things. Now, you could take it too far, which, of course, I always do in terms of my own guilt. I mean, when it comes to guilt, I am definitely the what was the name of that guy in The Lord of the Rings, the really bad guy who ran Mordor? Mordor was his city, and he had the really evil guy. When it comes to that, I am the head of all guilt in the world. But in the Jewish tradition, the idea is that you have this is really what fascinates me, and what so impresses me is atonement. When you say, "I'm going to atone for my sins," I'm going to atone for my sins. What it really means is you're going to rejoin other people and you're going to rejoin God. You will become again at one-ment with other people and God. So in fact, what the sin was, a silly word to use, what the trespass was, what the fault was, what you were doing wrong was falling away. I love this. Falling away from other people, going in the opposite direction of love and cooperation. And if you believe in God, falling away from God, not being attached to God. In fact, later on, I learned that the Jewish version of sin is there are various Jewish versions of hell. Is the separation. The further you are away from God, the more you're in hell. And to me, what that means is the further you're away from other people, God being other people and love, which is the DNA connection between you and all other people, the real connection. I mean, hate, of course, exists, right? Irritation, even murderous behavior and thoughts. But really, the bottom line is love. And there's a lot of sad songs in Judaism because of Jewish history, but during Rosh Hashanah, and especially during Yom Kippur, and I don't know the names of these things, once again, my ignorance of my own religion, but they would play often these appeals to God, which were so heart-wrenching. They were so heart-wrenching, and we had cantors. The singers in the synagogue, who would sing the inherited woes and melancholy and separation and yearning for God and yearning to be united with God and with other people. And this would come out as a kind of almost blood, would come out of people, that who were singing these songs. And the better the cantor, the more you were moved by it. And it was always a time of profound awe, reverence, and a kind of melancholy and sadness. This is the feeling. This is the feeling. This is the aura I remember from my childhood of Yom Kippur, or Yom Kippur, as they called it in my neighborhood. And it was a sense, first of all, you can hear it. That, by the way, is not Jewish music. That is Armenian music. But when I was searching for some music this morning, I was doing about 10 other things, and I was in a rush, and it didn't prepare well enough. But to me, it doesn't really matter, because since all people are connected anyhow, and that is the whole sense of disconnection and connection that we're talking about here, this music is, you know, right smack next to, practically, geographically, all that area. I mean, you can hear Arab music like this. This is Armenian music, which I think is... they're Russian Orthodox, aren't they? Armenians? I don't know. But this whole area of the world, there's a certain kind of root sadness, and there's plenty of historical and ethnic reasons for that. When it comes to the Armenians, they have massive sadness because of their constant mashing and bashing by the Turks, which went on for centuries and centuries and centuries. And great mass slaughters, mass murders, prejudices. When I was a kid and we were growing up, my grandparents used to constantly refer to, like, when you didn't eat your breakfast or you didn't eat lunch, or if you didn't eat whatever they gave you, because, you know, food was precious to them, and you didn't understand this because we were not children of the Depression. But at the time we were growing up, there was plenty of food on the table. And we weren't, you know, we were lower middle class, but one thing we always had was as much food as we wanted. But we were growing up with parents who didn't have as much food, and with grandparents who hardly had any food sometimes, who were in a state where they had to skip meals, or, you know, they were in pretty bad shape when they first came over here from Europe. And my grandparents, when they were growing up in the 1920s, in the teens and the 20s, was a tremendous mass murder and starvation of the Armenians by the Turks. And my grandparents, if you didn't, my grandmother would always say, if you didn't eat all your food, she'd say, you know, think about the starving Armenians, you know, and you should feel ashamed of yourself. By the time I got to be 10, 15 years old, my parents, or my mother at least, or people my parents' age, were telling me, remember the starving Chinese, because there were great famines and there was great starvation in China. But it was the starving Armenians that we used to hear about when we were really little from our grandparents. So this music you just heard is really is Armenian music, and it's very, very moving and sad. And it reminds me of the sorrow we felt during Yom Kippur. So during Yom Kippur and during these days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, what you're supposed to do, and we had it isolated to one day of Yom Kippur itself, but apparently, according to this, if Wikipedia is correct, and Wikipedia was not handed to Moses, you know, on Mount Sinai by God, but it's generally it's the place of, it's a source of information for most people that I know, who don't really study things that closely. So meanwhile, Wikipedia is saying that it's all of these days. What you do is, of course, you if you feel that you've fallen away from God, that your behavior, again, if you believe in God, you know, my attitude about God is closer to a kind of, not vague or a silly hippie kind of thing, but a kind of a universal connection and spirituality. When, after all, this is about at-one-ment connection, so I think I'm in good hands here. But do I believe in the God as pictured in the Bible? Do I believe in God as pictured by Charlton Heston and Cecil B. DeMille? No, not really. I don't. And am I worried that God is going to punish me? If God is going to punish me, I can't even imagine what that could be, considering what my life has already been like, especially this year. So if God is not punishing me now, I can't even imagine what God's punishment would be really like. I have no idea. And but I do sympathize very much with this hell. You know, like, what was it? Sartre in the play We Clo, No Exit. Sartre said hell is other people. Yeah, true, I suppose. But to me, what hell is, and I think for a lot of other people, what hell is being disconnected from other people. disconnected in two ways, both of which I've experienced, one of which in an extreme way. And that's why I said at the beginning of the program why I felt bad this time of year, because I see a lot of religious Jews and regular Jewish folks in my neighborhood walking around with their families and walking around with other people headed towards a synagogue or headed away from the synagogue. And they have a community. And I am not connected to any particular community. Because I was brought up so wild and so weird and strange, I never joined anything. And to this day, I really regret that. I don't have, you know, a regular circle of friends. I used to a long time ago, but it's not something I did naturally. I don't have a regular circle of friends. I don't have certainly don't have a regular synagogue that I belong to. I don't have a regular group of people that meets at a certain time to do certain things. And I've always been a loner, always been on the outside. And that's one kind of thing. And then the disconnection from other people, just not just in general, but people who love you or who you love or people who you like or who like you. And this kind of disconnection, I think this sense of disconnection is what sometimes gives me this urgency when I talk on the radio. And although it's kind of ironic that I'm sitting here talking to you over a bunch of wires and transmissions and internet connections. I have no idea what. Used to be radio waves, right, that would be broadcast through the air. But so I'm sitting here by myself talking to you, and the only people I'm seeing are people who are doing the engineering of the show. Usually that's who you see. But the feeling of being disconnected, Matt, you know, just think automatically. When you're living with somebody and you have an argument, somebody who you really care for deeply, who you love very much, and you have a bad argument and words are not spoken, when there's a silence, when there's a feeling in the apartment or in the house of silence and disconnection from other people that you love very much, that is one of the worst feelings there is. It's almost like being tortured. It's such a terrible feeling. And you're angry, right? You're angry. And you have every right to be angry, of course. I have every right to be angry, man. Look what she did. Look what he did. Look what he said. Look what she said. Or with your friends, with a really good friend. If you have a terrible argument or you say or do something which really offends a very good friend or a best friend of yours, and they don't talk to you. And I've been on both sides of that in my life. I've done that to other people, which was close to unforgivable, I think, because the motives were certainly nowhere near what they needed to be to just stop talking to somebody who was my best friend. But I did it for 3 years, like a fool, like a dope, like a jerk. And you feel a feeling when you argue with somebody who is a good friend of yours, or somebody who you really like, or somebody who you love. You feel this terrible feeling of being cast out from something, cast out from some beautiful circle, from some beautiful blessing state. And that's what they're talking about here on Yom Kippur, is connecting again with other people. And how do you do that? How do you connect with other people who you have fallen away from? Like I say, it could be just through you're so busy doing something else that you just aren't paying attention to them as much as you should. People often, even if they are spending time with people, aren't paying attention to them either. They're just not paying attention. They don't really see. I mean, I think most people, it seems to me, don't really see other people. They don't hear other people. They don't feel what other people are feeling at all. They just go about their business. And you have to do this in a way to protect yourself in the world. I mean, it's a hard world and people will walk right into you. I don't mean like physically bang into you. They will just open a door in your heart or your soul. And what's that, James Taylor song? Or is it Carole King? They'll take your soul if you let them. People will walk right over you, and they will walk right into you if you don't watch out. It's a tough world, right? And people will take what they want from you and not put anything back in. So people, naturally, you have to protect yourself. And in some places, depending on where you live, it could be a lot worse than other places. Sometimes in a city, it's really quite extraordinary. You got to watch, not you don't just watch your wallet, you got to watch your soul all the time. But this happens everywhere, right? So you protect yourself. You have defenses of all sorts of complicated defenses. You have various styles of warding off the possibility of being stolen from, having your heart stolen, having your soul stolen. You got to watch out. But on the other hand, there is really nothing worse, and maybe you disagree, but there is nothing worse than being disconnected from or fallen apart or drifted away from somebody who you love or who is very dear to you. And again, if you are religious, I'm presuming that it is a terrible, terrible feeling to be fallen away from God. And it could be, according to my friends who are very religious Jews, that one of the reasons that I've been feeling, you know, sort of disconnected and sad for a good part of my life is because I have never really connected with God, my maker, that I have not connected with God. And depending on your conception of God, again, there is some, I think, there is some truth to that. There is a kind of truth to that where it's not, like I say, it's not some big old man in the sky with a long beard and, you know, who has the power of life and death over me. But it is a sense of an eternal connection that connects absolutely everything. I mean, not to be too sappy about it, but it connects absolutely everything. When somebody is being bombed in Gaza, when a rocket is hitting some house in Israel, when these lunatic ISIS people are beheading other people, when people are starving from famine and flood in Africa or Pakistan, don't you just sometimes, I mean, it's far away and it's not happening to you. When you see people on the street closer up who are troubled, who are hungry, who are poor, who are ignorant, who are doing things that you would never do, let's say, with your kids or with other people, you feel a feeling of, you could judge these people. You could feel sorry. You can write out a check, or you could use your, of course, you can use your credit card online, and you could send money to relieve people's suffering. You can do that. Or you can hand out some spare change. You can hand out some loose change, whatever you have, or more than that to people who are begging on the street. You want to help people sometimes. But, of course, there are so many people that need so much help that after a while, what would you have left? What would you have left? But you feel it. You do feel it. And so what happens during these what's called days of awe between Rosh Hashanah and between Yom Kippur, when God apparently for the next year, at least you get to do it every year. It's not like forever. If you screw up, you're going to just one time that you're going to go to hell and there's no application. There's no court of appeals. God, you know, has closed the book forever on you. No, no, no. The book gets to be opened every year. But, you know, you would like to stay in God's good books. And once again, if I'm using God in a certain way, I think you'll understand what I mean. You'd like to stay in the universe's good books, in this special connection we have to each other, in the great sort of singing, dancing, you know, spin of eternity. You want to stay in the right chord. You want to stay in the right step with all of this. You don't want to constantly be separated from people. I think the times that I've been the most miserable, and I'm going through a period like that now, is when I'm the most isolated from other people, when I don't take the trouble to call other people up or to meet people or to visit with people or to have people come over and visit me, even my own kids, when it's difficult for me to talk to people or to spend time with people, that's when I feel the most adrift. And it makes sense because you're not connected with other people. And I have to say that I do I do envy my friends who feel this connection with God as they conceive God to be God, you know, in whatever it is in the way it's described for religious Jews or the way it's understood by religious Jews. So during this time of the year, I see people who are walking together with each other, neighbors, friends. I see people going in and out of the synagogue, communing with each other and communing with God. And it accentuates this feeling I always have of always being on my own, of always being isolated. Now, what are the technical ways that you deal with this during these days of awe? Well, you go to other people for forgiveness. You go to other people for forgiveness. And let's say that you have hurt somebody else, and you know that you've hurt somebody else. That's the first step. You have to be aware. There's awareness involved here. Sometimes this awareness disappears during the course of the day or the week or the month or the year. You're just so busy, or you're so busy doing for yourself or your family or protecting yourself in a necessary way, that you become unaware of other people, even unaware of the people that you're actually supposed to be working for or protecting. You just get so consumed by something else, so caught up in something else. So you're aware of the fact, first of all, that you have said or done something. It doesn't have to, it could be temporary or minor, or it could be a major thing. You become aware of this. And either somebody else makes you aware of it, or you, even better, you become aware of it. Finally, it dawns on you, you know, one day, or, you know, during a course of a week, a month, or the year, that you've hurt somebody else, all right? First thing, you become aware. It's awareness, okay? Second thing is that you have to feel a sincere regret in your heart. And this is part of it. This is what I was always taught about Yom Kippur. You have to feel a sincere regret in your heart. And then you will go to this other person. You will go to this other person with this sincere regret. And you will ask for forgiveness. You seek atonement, at one-ment with this other person. And you go and you ask for forgiveness. Now, if you really mean it and you're really sincere and you go and you ask for forgiveness, that doesn't mean you're going to be forgiven. Okay? It doesn't necessarily work that way. I mean, some people will not forgive you. They consider what you did or who you are to them and who you've been to them during the course of that day, that week, that month, that year, or over the years, they consider you to be an unforgivable person. They can't forgive you for what you've done. Now, a lot of people have this feeling, and it's way left over, and it's way overdue. It's past its sell-by date, believe me. And I know this because I'm an expert at this. There are people who find what their parents did to them when they were growing up as unforgivable, right? Or, and in some cases, when it comes to sexual abuse or violent abuse that that adults inflicted on children, there are some people who find, and I think I'm one of them, that borders on the unforgivable. But here's the thing. So, all right, so you go to somebody and you ask for forgiveness, and they say, no, forget about it. Or they say something even ruder, which I could say on the radio here, but I'm not feeling that way today. So they say, no, I'm not forgiving you. You know, get lost. Go away. There's no way that you could apologize or atone for what you did to me. It's just, and you did it over and over again all the time, and I refuse to accept your apology. Or I refuse to forgive you for the regret that you're expressing. And I really don't believe, and this is the second part of it, I don't believe that you really mean it anyhow. I've heard you say this before. Okay, so, but you have to really mean it in your heart. You go to them a second time, and you say, I truly do regret what I said or did. And they may say for a second time, no, it's not happening. And yet you go for a third time, because if you're sincere, you really want to achieve this at one-ment with this other person. You want to, or could be God or the universe or whatever. You go and you say, I really do need to be forgiven because I really regret what I did. I know I hurt you. I know I disconnected myself from you. And that's a thing that is really hurtful for both of us. Can you forgive me? If you are not forgiven the third time, then you did your best, providing always that it's sincere regret. And I always took it for granted. I don't know if it's part of the religion, but I always took it for granted that it's not just that you are expressing the words of regret, but that you have not only just a sincere regret in your heart, but you have the sincere desire not to keep repeating the same behavior all the time. Or what difference does it make? I mean, how many times have you been with somebody, or have you been that person who does something really wrong? You know it's wrong, and you automatically say, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I've been in the position where I've screwed up so badly and acted so badly with other people in my life. And I've encountered people like that who I've known, too, and grew up with one of them, who are always telling you they're sorry. But after a while, you don't believe them because they keep acting that way. So I don't know if this is part of the ritual here, but for, you know, the days of awe during Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But I always take it for granted that you are supposed to really intend, you know, when you're asking for forgiveness, not to behave this way anymore. Now, you may fall away from it again during the year. You may not have this constant state of at-one-ment. You may be disconnected again from other people or from God during the course of the year. But it won't be because you deliberately mean to or because you automatically, instantaneously just said the words and got them out of your mouth and got forgiven. Maybe there are some people who can't be forgiven. Are there people in your life that you think cannot be forgiven for something they said or did? A lot of people I know, and, you know, it's sad, too, because I'm one of them. They cherish their hurts. They cherish the offenses done against them like a precious jewel. They keep it inside them until it becomes their entire identity. Almost my entire life, up until including now, unfortunately, I have held grudges against my parents in my old age. How foolish and stupid, because, and this is where forgiveness is so important, if you can't forgive other people, no matter who they are or what they did, I mean, and maybe there's some people in the world who can't be forgiven. If you think in historical terms, who could forgive Stalin? Who could forgive Hitler? I mean, these people are unforgivable, right? However, eventually, even though they're not around anymore, if you wanted to be free, if you want to be free of the shackles of wounded pride, and if you want to be free of the shackles that that bind any soul that is angry all the time, that always wants to spend their whole life getting revenge, if you are fixed in place, like your feet are in cement, and this causes you to be isolated and not to even be free enough to be your own self, it's because you can't forgive. Now, a lot of us know this, and yet we still find it hard to forgive. What's that phrase? Forgive and forget. You can't forget what people did. You can't let it fade from your consciousness and live your own free life, finally, unless you forgive them first. Now, I know this, and I've actually had this experience before with people. But people who are no longer here anymore, and people who I know in my own life right now, that you have to forgive them. You have to. Now, most people think they're more sinned against than sinning. I think it's more common that people are pissed off because they think that various people or the world has done them a bad turn all the time. And it's not them. I mean, they're perfectly decent. They're okay. But other people have screwed them over. Well, probably true. But really? Are you are you really that good? I don't know. During these times right now, during these days of awe, I don't expect anybody to be coming to me and asking for my forgiveness. It's much more on the other side of the ledger. I mean, my behavior, even though I could think at various times, I have reasons for my behavior because of the rough year I've gone through. My behavior towards other people is definitely that which needs to be reformed, needs to be regretted, and needs to be carried to other people and asked for forgiveness for. Pretty unwieldy sentence there, right? So one thing I'm going to ask for forgiveness for in advance, this is a pre-request special. In advance, I ask for forgiveness from anybody who is a knowledgeable or religious Jew about anything I said today that isn't really true to the days that we're going through now, these holy days, or to the religion itself. And one thing I'm going to grant, sight unseen, because I can't really see you, and you can't see me. But one thing I'm going to grant is something that I've had to work on my entire life is not only am I going to try to forgive people who aren't even alive anymore, for my own self, the forgiveness will free me. I'm going to forgive anybody who is not listening to my radio shows regularly. Anybody in the world who is not, I used to think that every word I uttered was something that people had to hear, and I felt bad if they didn't hear it. Now I don't feel that way so much anymore. So I forgive everybody who hasn't heard every word I said. If you were just cleaning the toilet and didn't hear the last thing I said, I forgive you. If you didn't hear every show I ever did, I forgive you. So that's it. This is my Yom Kippur forgiveness, and this is my asking for forgiveness. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.